Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Richard Heady, who is the Principal of Climate Mitigation Services, who was previously with the Rocky Mountain Institute. He's the author of Measuring Energy Sustainability, Evaluating Your Nation's Energy Development, a manual for users of helio indicators. And he's currently working on a book on the global risks of Antarctica's climate-sensitive ice sheets. He's also the lead author of the new paper, 8 Years in the Making, published by the journal Climatic Change, which identifies the 90 commercial and state-owned entities responsible for producing two-thirds of man-made greenhouse gases causing global warming, half of which have been produced since 1986. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Heady.
Ian, it's my pleasure to be speaking with you.
And your study is an extremely important study, I think, particularly in the context of the UN climate conference that just finished in Warsaw, where there was no agreement. It just fizzled into irrelevance. Instead of the word commitment in previous documents, they substitute the commitment with contributions. There's nothing binding about it. And again, the breakdown was over the familiar division between the haves and have-nots, the developed countries and the developing countries like India and China. But your study just absolutely explodes that idea. The real division is not between the energy haves and have-nots. It's between the producers and consumers.
Yes, we felt there was some important work to be done in looking at where the carbon in the atmosphere has come from in terms of the major producers in carbon over the past 150 years or so. So instead of looking at to the responsibility of nations as emitters and as primarily responsible for mitigation and dealing with climate issue, we wanted to look at the producers themselves and shift some attention to them. And what we've done is attributed the carbon that ends up in the atmosphere to the fossil fuels and cement produced by the 90 largest entities the world has ever seen, 51 of which are investor-owned companies. So we feel the shareholders have some stake in how they act henceforth in terms of their policies to reduce their production of fossil fuels. And so we've also looked at 30 state-owned energy companies, usually called national oil and gas companies, such as Saudi Aramco and Petrobras and Statoil in Norway, and looked at their historic record of fossil fuel production by fuel, oil, gas, and coal, for each year as far back in history as we can get their production data, which starts in the 1850s for some of the oldest coal companies, and from the 1890s or 1900s, early 1900s, for the major oil and gas companies. And when we do that exercise, Ian, we've attributed 63% of all industrial sources of CO2 emissions to those 90 entities.
63%?
Correct.
And in terms of oil and gas, that dominates that 63%. I believe you mentioned cement. That is a smaller contributor.
Yeah, it's about 4 or 5% of our inventory, because we're just looking at six independent, though very large, cement producers in Europe, in Mexico and China.
And these companies, these 90 commercial and state-owned entities responsible for producing two-thirds of man-made greenhouse gases causing global warming, half of these emissions have been produced since 1986. So that would indicate an exponential increase, isn't it? I mean, it's extraordinary.
Well, it is an exponential increase. And even through the recession, global emissions of carbon dioxide were still increasing. And so to get a handle on actually peaking and then reducing emissions is going to be exceedingly difficult. And we thought that some focus on the historic contribution by these major entities would help the matter and perhaps help them contribute to solving the problem as opposed to being bystanders, albeit profitable bystanders, to continued climate disruption. It's important to note that we have not only accounted for their direct emissions, which is what the companies typically track when they report in their annual reports or sustainability reports. The direct emissions would include their own use of their own produced fuels. It would include CO2 from flaring operations where they're producing oil that is not near natural gas pipelines, and so that gas is simply flared. And also CO2 removed from raw natural gas. Typically, there's several percent of CO2 in produced gas that has to be vented in order to produce marketable gas. And then you have another large component, particularly in coal mining, about fugitive and vented methane. very potent greenhouse gas. And these companies have strong incentives and opportunities to reduce direct emissions, and they have done so. Most companies, particularly the leading oil and gas companies, have done a great job of paying attention to and reducing those emissions. But that comprises 10% of our total inventory for each entity. 90% comes from carbon contained in the products that they sell.
And my understanding, though, Richard Heady, is that this fracking that's going on fairly energetically around the country and around the world, the data's not in the extent to which hydraulic fracturing produces fissures in the shale underground, but some of it leaks out both at the wellhead and at other places. And if this is the case, the methane leakage from fracking may make the whole idea of switching from coal to natural gas, because of natural gas contributes about 50% less CO2, it becomes a wash if we find out that the methane is leaking, because methane is such an aggressive global warming gas.
That's correct, Ian. The jury is still out on what the leakage rate is. There is monitoring programs and estimation programs going on, so hopefully we'll have a better answer on that issue soon. But you're right that the climate benefit of natural gas is very sensitive to the methane leakage rate.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Heady, who's the principal of Climate Mitigation Services. He was previously with the Rocky Mountain Institute, and he is the lead author of a new paper, 8 years in the Making, published in the journal Climatic Change, which identifies the 90 commercial and state-owned entities responsible for producing two-thirds of man-made greenhouse gases causing global warming, half of which have been produced since 1986. And I think what's really important about your study, Richard, is that while there are thousands of oil and gas and coal producers around the world, in terms of those in charge of these companies, those responsible, those that you can identify, you've argued that you could basically put all of these people, these coal and oil producers, both commercial and state-owned, in a Greyhound bus.
Well, yes, there may be two Greyhound buses, but in any case, a small number of individuals who will make the major decisions going forward about what kinds of capital investments to make, whether we're going into deeper and more remote and extreme environments to find the remaining fossil fuels, particularly deep offshore and Arctic regions, not only north of the United States and Alaska and Canada, but also Russia and Norway. And what is the long-term business plan? We are fairly confident that the proven reserves already held on the books of major fossil fuel producers exceed by a factor of two or three the amount of carbon that the atmosphere can absorb without very dramatic and costly climate damages. So that already exists. So the question becomes, how many more hundreds of billions of dollars are we going to invest in additional fossil fuel production and reserve capacity? And there's some risk there that we're not accounting for the cost of dramatic climate changes and the cost of our fuels. So the financiers, the lenders, the shareholders of these corporations, as well as consumers, need to be aware of which companies are leading on the climate issue and which ones are laggards.
And at this point, what is the evidence? The big companies responsible for this two-thirds of the contribution to climate change from 1751 to 2010, and of course, half of which has been produced since 1986, are Chevron, Exxon, BP, Royal Dutch Shell, and British Coal, Peabody Energy, BHP, Billiton. And then, of course, you've got Saudi Aramco, Russia's Gazprom, Norway Statoil, Libya, all kinds of countries that are a part of the old dichotomy between the energy haves and the have-nots and the big northern industrial consumers and the struggling third world. That's becoming a false dichotomy as a result of your study. Where does the accountability begin? With the biggest? I mean, what's your sense of how we should respond to this?
Well, part of the problem is that we're not paying the full cost of using fossil fuels when we buy gasoline at the pump or natural gas to heat our buildings or coal to generate electricity. So to the extent that we can increase the price by a carbon tax or other means to increase the price, that would help. But there's huge value for the fossil fuel producers in having what are exceptionally strong fuels. They're easy to store and transport. They're cheaper than the alternatives in many cases. And so they have a strong financial incentive to keep producing carbon fuels because they're very profitable. Some of the largest companies earn tens of billions of dollars per quarter, and they will have a continued incentive to keep doing so.
Well, but having identified whose fingerprints are on the problem, to me it seems a bit like the drug business. You know, you can identify the drug kingpins, but at the end of the day, we have this ridiculous war on drugs where they get the small fry and they don't get the kingpins. But what they're completely in denial about, particularly here in the United States, is that we blame Mexico for the drug problem, but we are the consumers here in the United States. So if you can identify the fingerprints of global warming on these big companies, big oil companies and big state-owned oil and coal companies, that's not the whole picture, is it? You know, it's the users that also have to pony up here and either, you know, get educated or get real.
Yes, well, it's true. All consumers, as well as producers, have a stake in this, and we're all responsible for not only the historic emissions, but the future ones. And we need to come to grips with that. And I think we need to not only educate the consumers about expecting higher costs, we're borrowing essentially from the future. The future costs of climate change will mostly be borne by our children and grandchildren, and we are subsidizing fossil fuel development not only in this country to the tune of $4 billion a year, but we're subsidizing consumption of fossil fuels to nearly $600 billion a year globally. So we're lowering the price of a fuel that we need to increase the price of. And I think the market signal, the price signal of the fossil fuels is the most important way we can help educate ourselves and drive investment into low or zero carbon alternatives. We're not going to solve the problem if carbon fuels cost less and don't reflect the price of using those resources. That's what really needs to happen.
So in terms of in the corporate world, you know, because half of the problem is also Russia and China and the state-owned companies. But if you were able to get a carbon tax through, and the Australians passed one, and the new Conservative government led by a global warming denier is trying to revoke it. But if you could get a carbon tax through, which, of course, is completely unlikely given the United States Senate. But if you could, where would that money go?
Well, I think some of that money needs to be returned to some of the consumers who are low-income consumers. And some of it should go to investments in renewable energy. But we also need to understand that the companies themselves should support domestic as well as international efforts to pass legislation and treaties to deal with climate change. For the most part, they're sitting on the sidelines. And yes, they're doing major investments in reducing their own corporate emissions. But they need to support real international and domestic solutions to this, as well as invest in lower carbon fuels on their own and make other efforts to contribute to solving this problem.
So if this is no longer a have versus have not situation, and the real issue is the dichotomy between those that produce and those that consume, even though there's culpability on all sides here, what's your sense then of... We know, you know, for the longest time, ExxonMobil, the biggest, I guess, in the world, the biggest contributor, was led by a global warming denier. And now I believe they're beginning to realize that it's for real. My understanding is that the insurance companies are quite concerned about the future. And you're saying that what's really happening here is that we're subsidizing these very profitable energy producers who are, in fact, at the end of the day, going to cost us infinitely more with the damage that these emissions are going to do to the climate, with rising sea levels costing untold billions and trillions of dollars in damage. We've already had a precursor of that from these superstorms. So what role can other corporations that aren't energy producers like insurance companies play in this wake-up call that we need?
Well, you know, I'm not an expert in the insurance industry, but I am aware that they're very concerned about their own exposure to climate damages and infrastructure destruction that they are insuring. And so that, I think they will pass those costs on, and that will help educate other entities and municipalities, infrastructure owners, that the cost of climate change is going to rise because they can see that in their premium bill. The reinsurance companies in Europe in particular have been particularly aggressive in passing this message along. that the cost of climate damage is on the rise and will continue to rise. And so I think the market signals really are coming in from all directions, from shareholders, who I think will become more active, from large investors and fossil fuel companies, from universities and other endowments, and from insurers, like you say, coming back to the producers themselves, saying there's some risk in our future business plan if we expect to produce all the reserves we have on the books and spend hundreds of billions of dollars more in expanding our reserves. There's some risk to this. Maybe we need to rethink about what our long-term plan for this company is.
Well, Richard Heady, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. It was my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Heady, who's the principal of Climate Mitigation Services. He was previously with the Rocky Mountain Institute and is the author of Measuring Energy Sustainability, Evaluating Your Nation's Energy Development, a manual for users of helio indicators. And he's currently working on a book on the global risks of Antarctica's climate-sensitive ice sheets. He's also the lead author of the new paper, 8 Years in the Making, published in the journal Climatic Change, which identifies the 90 commercial and state-owned entities responsible for producing two-thirds of man-made greenhouse gases causing global warming, half of which have been produced since 1986. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.